The Inner Voice Show is a dialogue between the host and the listeners about their relationships. This show is not an attempt to assess, diagnose, or treat any mental health or illness condition. Please consult your physician, psychiatrist, or psychotherapist for personal matters.
Inner Voice. A heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I will bring you the last of the series of conversation with Dr. David Burns. He's a professor emeritus of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine and the best-selling author of Feeling Good and his latest book, Feeling Great. We will be talking and completing our conversations about the ways to open up your mind and let go of your negative beliefs for good. Then I will bring you Gary Heil, an internationally acclaimed expert in the field of leadership management and organizational culture, and the author of Choose Love, Not Fear, How the Best Leaders Built Cultures of Engagement and Innovation that Unleash Human Potential. My two guests are so amazing, and I have such a great time speaking with them that I don't have time to bring you the tip of the week and the research. So enjoy, don't go anywhere, we'll be right back. Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks? Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at Fujian.com, Foojan.com.
Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm excited to have Dr. David Burns with us. He is the adjunct professor emeritus in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine and the author of the best-selling book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy and the Feeling Good Handbook. And for all of you who are waiting for his latest book, it's coming out, Feeling Great. And it will be out here in September. So welcome to the show, Dr. Burns.
Thank you. Great to be back, and I've loved the previous three segments on my work with this beautiful young woman who was in despair for fear that her husband's going to die. He's working on the front lines in the emergency room, intensive care unit doctor in New York City, and we've kind of done our treatment and reduced her negative feelings dramatically, a lot of them all the way to zero. And then I just talked to her today, just a couple of hours ago, for an incredible and surprising follow-up.
It's amazing that, as you had shared with me, that when someone is facing reality as is, that their cognition, their thought process, and their emotion is very, very different than if they're working on some assumption that is in their own head, and they're having a lot more intense reaction to it, where this person actually faced one of the fear that she actually had, but this time, because there was a partial reality to it, she could deal with it in a whole different way.
yeah, what happened? You see, she has this thought, my husband might get corona and die, and she's 50 to 100% believing that thought and it's creating intense panic. Well, she just discovered that her husband did get the coronavirus, and he does have it. And that his shortness of breath, which she had thought was a panic attack, in retrospect, it was when he was getting it in his lungs, and he was having breathing difficulties. And the really neat thing is that he has a mild case, and he, because his fever is not any longer elevated, he's able to go and continue his heroic work. In fact, he hasn't missed any work. The poor guy is out there on the front line 16 hours a day doing heroic work for the people of New York. But the moment she found out he has coronavirus, her anxiety absolutely disappeared, and she went into a state of euphoria because she realized he's not going to die, and soon he'll be no longer carrying a carrier of the virus. He'll be able to come home and live with us again, and she's just feeling so joyous. I did a Zoom session with her today and saw her beautiful three children, and they're, you know, on all over the place on top of her, and mommy this and mommy that. And then she gave us some tips on how mothers can with children can home all the time can maybe function more effectively in this coronavirus era. But I was so happy for her. She's such a beautiful person and deserves this gift of joy that she has now. And one other thing I wanted to mention is when I was in practice, I saw the same thing all the time. I had many men that I treated, especially, feared going bankrupt, their worst fear. And most of them were successful attorneys. And for some reason, attorneys, I treated tons of attorneys, and practically every one of them had this intense fear of going bankrupt and becoming homeless. But in my practice, there were four people who did go bankrupt, who had intense fears of going bankrupt. Like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna go bankrupt, my wife will leave me, I'll end up a homeless person and this type of thing. And in every single one of them, the day they went bankrupt, their depression and anxiety suddenly disappeared entirely, because the reality was not dangerous. It was just the distorted thoughts. It's hard for people to grasp this idea that when you're feeling intense depression and anxiety and rage and shame and hopelessness, the thoughts that upset you are not a reflection of reality, but they're distorted and illogical. And when you change the way you think, you can change the way you feel. And the reason those four men recovered the moment they went bankrupt, because they discovered that their negative thoughts were not at all valid. Their wives didn't leave them. They didn't run out of food. Life kept on going pretty much the same, which isn't to say we don't have real problems. And sometimes, you know, healthy fear is appropriate. Healthy sadness when you lose a loved one is certainly appropriate. We were not trying to make people happy all the time, but I think it's just so fantastic that we now have powerful tools to help people change the way you think and feel, and quickly, often in a single session. Now, in my experience, 90% of the time when I work with people, I work with them for 1-2 hour session, and then we're pretty much done at that point. And I think it's great to have tools now that don't take months or years or sometimes decades before you can experience dramatic change. And I would say the goal of therapy is not just a reduction in depression and anxiety, but a total obliteration of depression and anxiety, and even more than that, shooting into enlightenment or joy. Anyway, that's my spiel.
Yes, what I was also gaining from what you said is when we are really dealing with the reality, all we have accessibility to all of our skills at that moment, and all of those skills shape us and the survival and everything that we need to do in real time in order to take care of whatever it is. But when we're just sitting in distorted ideas which have nothing to do with reality, we can't use those skills because there's nothing to use them for. There's not really actions that we could do in order to take care of ourselves. We just sit in this virtual reality that we just created, like a horror story, without any type of action. And it seems like when we really face the as is here and now, then all the skills and the actions are there in order to handle. So whether it's the, you know, the coronavirus that we're all kind of experiencing at this point one way or another, or is the fear of job loss or what's going to happen in 3 months or what's going to happen to the economy of the world and me in it, or, you know, am I going to lose my husband or wife or somebody? I think the what ifs that we're putting in front of us, we just look at the vision and scare the crap out of ourselves versus at any point when we have to face it, then we face it in a different way.
Yes, that's beautifully stated. The depression and anxiety are the world's oldest cons because you're telling yourself things that aren't true. And although that sounds judgmental, it's liberating because when you change the way you think, you can change the way you feel, even when you're facing something like Taylor was, as horrific as the coronavirus. It's still the distortions in your thoughts that create the vast majority, if not all of your emotional pain. And it's an amazing discovery. Philosophers have been saying this for 2,000 years, but it's so basic, it's kind of hard for people to grasp. It goes in one ear and one out the other. But it's a brand of enlightenment, and it's absolutely mind blowing when you can get it and suddenly grasp that, wow, this really is true, and I really can change the way I think and feel.
And you have a beautiful way of saying and distinguishing between the depression and anxiety and how it operates in our world. Can you say a little bit about the distinction between the two? Like the
oh sure
the brain yeah. The thought process does when we're depressed. What does it do when we're anxious and panicked?
Yeah, depression always results from the idea that you've lost something that's central to your self-esteem. So you say, I'm a loser because I screwed up at X, or I'm unlovable because my boyfriend rejected me. It's this kind of, you know, I'm no good, and the future is hopeless, and everything is terrible. Panic and anxiety, on the other hand, result from fortune telling, telling yourself that something is about to happen that hasn't yet happened. Like when I get on that plane, I just know it'll run into turbulence and crash. My teacher, or one of my teachers, I would say Aaron Beck, put it this way. He said, like, you can imagine that you've fallen off a cliff, but you're clinging to the top of the cliff by your fingers, and your anxiety would be, oh my gosh, I could fall at any moment. That's anxiety. And then depression is more like you're already fallen and broken beyond repair at the bottom of the cliff. But a lot of people have both, as Taylor did, at the same time. 100% of depressed patients or depressed individuals will also have elevated anxiety. And 50% of anxious patients will have depression. Some anxious patients are only anxious, but not depressed. But all depressed patients are depressed and anxious as well.
Thank you very much. And when you're looking at the audience that, for example, might be watching us and looking at dealing with the anxiety that is around the medical aspect of it. What's going to happen to me if I get out? I've had clients who I was speaking to this morning, which this act of even getting out to a grocery store with a mask, with everything, and adding all of these components of what if the virus is there, and then what do I do with my hand, and then what do I do when I touch the mask and bring it out? And then, you know, she panicked herself more and more and more, where she was just sitting in the car not knowing what to do with her hands and the mask anymore because of all these information she was getting every time she turned on the TV about what's going to happen then there's this anxiety about I lost my job and the whole world economy has collapsed. Nobody's working. We have no idea. Nothing is going to go on until July. How am I going to handle the next 6 months? So it's more like this panic mode that it gets exasperated by the news. And everyone just sits in this panic at this moment about these different, one medical aspect and health, and another one there, you know, the economy. And they get frozen, literally frozen at that moment. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I can't help people in a general way. I say, give me one moment that you were upset, and then let's take a daily mood log and describe what was going on, sitting in my car or whatever, just like Taylor did, crying myself to sleep in an intense panic at night. Circle your feelings and write down how powerful each one is on a scale from 0 to 100, and then write down what you're telling yourself. What are the thoughts? And then I empathize with the person without trying to help them. And once they give me an A on empathy, then I say, do you want help with this? What kind of help would you want? Would you want all these feelings to disappear? And they say, oh, yes. And then I say, but wait a minute. What do these thoughts and feelings show about you that's positive and awesome? And what are some benefits? You see the woman with panicked about the virus. She doesn't want her panic to go to zero. Then the panic is keeping her alive. There's beautiful things about all of these negative thoughts and feelings. And then once you see that, I say, well, what would you like to dial the feelings down to? And then only then do I go to the methods to help them crush these distorted negative thoughts that are triggering all that pain. So I slow down in my work with people. I go step by step. And I go as slow as I can so I can do really high speed cures. You have to take it systematically to get the mind-boggling result. And it usually takes about 90 minutes.
Beautiful. So if people are listening right now, if they're panicking, is what I'm hearing with Dr. Burns, is if they're panicking about something, maybe they can start writing down their mood and their thought process, the negative mood, what's happening, and their emotions and the thought process.
Absolutely. Or pick up my book, When Panic Attacks. You graciously mentioned the others, but that's one of the newer books, and my daughter edited it. It's not long, and it shows you how to do a daily mood log in chapter 3. It presents 40 techniques for smashing anxiety. It's kind of a step-by-step thing. It'll like bring to life the things I've been talking about in these last four segments.
Beautiful. So just go to feelinggood.com and everything is there.
Oh yeah, the book pages, you can link right into Amazon there. And then I've got all kinds of free podcasts. You can put in panic, anxiety, and all my free podcasts on that topic will come right up. There's a search function. You can search on any mental health topic on my website. There's tons of free resources. I have a free class now for the general public, 18 free lessons on depression that you can get. I'm creating a free class on anxiety. I'm about ready to start posting that. I have a free class I'm half pretty much developed for trauma, for habits and addictions. My website is all free resources, primarily for the general public, as well as for therapists who want to learn about these new techniques.
Beautiful. Feelinggood.com. That's where you can go and get all of these resources from Dr. David Burns. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on the show again. Every time you're better than the time before, but you were so good the first time you couldn't get any better, and yet you keep getting better. And just a joy to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Same here. And for all of you who are listening and viewing us, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zane. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it. Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so excited to have Gary Heil with me. He's an internationally acclaimed expert in the field of leadership management and organizational culture. His work has helped some of the most prominent leaders and companies in the world, including former presidents of the United States, Fortune 100 companies, and professional sports coaches, become more innovative and culturally vital. As an acclaimed author, attorney, corporate director, television commentator, and an athletic coach, Gary brings a range of diverse perspectives to his work on leadership management and innovation. Gary and Ryan Heil, and they share their wisdom in their new book, Choose Love, Not Fear, How the Best Leaders Built Cultures of Engagement and Innovation that Unleashes Human Potential. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
It is wonderful to have you. I was going through the book. I love the book. First of all, I love it that you choose love. I think this is not a word that usually is used a lot. It's too fifi to be used for management and corporations and, you know, to consult presidents with it and all of that. But I love it that you chose love for leadership. So talk about that. How come love now?
Well, you know, we didn't start out to write a book about love, right? Because everybody I said we're going to use this, they're like, oh my God, really? Your book's going to sell 3 copies. You know, and it was like that, except we had just come to the end of a decade-long study where we interviewed more than 700 leaders. Our premise was that people talk a better game of leadership than they play, right? For all the $15 billion a year we spend in leadership development, it's not making much of a difference. And, you know, only a third of most employees are highly engaged. 70% don't trust their bosses. 52% are looking for a new job. So we knew there was a problem. We wanted to find out why leaders weren't playing a better game of leadership. So we went out to do these interviews. And some of the things we found we expected, that the biggest inhibitor to better leadership is the present culture that most people work in. And things that we might have expected, but the one thing we didn't expect to find that we found were that of these 700 leaders, there were this small microcosm of leaders who created exemplary teams that not only won a lot of games or made a lot of money or had a lot of students who loved learning, but they did it over time. And when you walked into their presence, the feeling that you got was fundamentally different. It was basically, you could sense the different relationships that people had on the team. And now I had a mentor 25 years ago named Jan Carlson who ran an airline in Europe called SAS, Scandinavian Air Service. And he told me that the first job every leader has to do is he has to make a choice. Choose love or choose fear. You can't do both. Of course, as a therapist, you would probably know that much better than I do. But I thought I got it 25 years ago, but I really didn't get it. It took a crazy football coach in Clemson, South Carolina, to basically show me. He would say all the time, we're going to win because we love each other. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And then I met Alan Mulally, who was the CEO of Ford when the Ford turnaround happened. And he would say, love them up before you coach them up. And then I'd meet a football coach in Concord, California, De La Salle, and Bob Lasseter, who would talk about loving his kids. And, you know, every place I met these people where they had these great ball clubs or great companies or great cultures, they basically talked about the relationship they had with the people and the people on the team had with each other. And I was, not all of them used the word love, but I was shocked by how many did. And we felt at the end that really Jan Carlson was right 25 years ago, is that when you choose positive emotion, when you choose love, it's fundamentally different than choosing fear. And he was right. The default position of most companies is they choose fear, manipulation, rather than love. And I think that fear makes us stupid and positive emotion gives us a chance to be great.
I have really experienced that. And it's given that in my line of work, that there has to be this kind of like an unconditional regard and acceptance of clients when they sit there. But the same thing you just said, when I love them, like when I have this this feeling that I allow my caring to be there, not just my professional therapist hat, but a personal caring that shows up, the same intervention, Gary, pulls through and goes right through somebody's heart and it sticks. And the same intervention, so it's not like the skill, the same intervention does not stick when it's just the, you know, like the type of a separate professionalism that I share. And I've really gotten that when I create that type of a connection with someone, that it's for them, like loving them for who they are and the opportunities and the potential that any of us as human beings have, and loving that space, it really, really creates a whole different type of motivation for that group. And you talk about motivation in your book, and you say that we actually need a new theory of hope and motivation that we could bring for you know, for our work and in the corporations and leadership. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, when you, as love relates to that, right? So one of the things that's totally interesting is that love for leaders that think like that isn't just an emotion. It's a lens through which they see the world, and they see the world really differently. And so one of the things I'd noticed over time, I would go in and say, how do you motivate people to groups or to executive development programs? And, you know, most of the time people don't really have a very good theory of motivation. And, you know, when they do, they usually talk about the manipulation of rewards and punishments to get people to do what they want them to do, which seems to me better for training a dog than a person. But so we went to write this chapter on motivation, and my son, or my co-author, who's much brighter than I am, Dr. Heil, he would always say to me, we should start off with something simple, like how parents, even parents, can't help themselves but bribing people and how to think about things. So he had us start this chapter with the dumbest story ever about parents manipulating their kids to eat broccoli, right? And his point was, you might be able to get me to eat the broccoli, maybe, but you're never going to get me to love the broccoli, right? And there's 80 years of research that shows the more you pay me, manipulate me, to get me to do something, the more if it's a, if you do this, I will give you that kind of motivation, the less interested I become in the underlying activity and the less competent I become at it. There's 80 years of research, but that doesn't stop us from continuing to believe that the main motivation people have when they come to work is economic and manipulative. And, you know, as a director in a public company, I had a line of compensation consultants outside my door all the time trying to tell me if I would only learn to manipulate people better. And it's just not true. And that we need to think about human beings as willing to take responsibility, and we need to think about leaders instead of responsible for other people's motivation, which we're not. We need to think about leaders as providing an opportunity for people to do great things. Then they make their choice whether to take that natural motivation that they were given at birth and bring it to our cause. We don't motivate them. We don't have the power. The most we can do is create an opportunity for them to do great stuff, and hopefully they'll bring that energy to our cause.
You just talked about the culture of manipulation, that it's a lot there in companies, in sales and marketing, and in leadership, in management, obviously in parenting that you just talked about. And there's a disrespect in that. It's innate disrespect, as if I can fool you. And I think that is so against the other side of the love and the compassion and seeing you and seeing what's possible and all of that. It's just a very, very different type of a lens when we go, as you talked about, from a manipulation versus acceptance and love. You also would, since we're talking about motivation, you also in your book say, seek commitment, non-compliance, and you say, stop trying to motivate people. You can't motivate them. People are born motivated. Motivation is a choice, and leaders only create compelling opportunities in which the best people are likely to choose to fully engage in the process. And the ones that have an invitation with an opportunity business, that motivation of them is not, it creates like the commitment that they want, their responsibility. They want to do it. They own it. Can you share a bit about that?
Well, I think so. I mean, when we say follow us, when a leader says follow me, but implicitly or explicitly, you know, the follower always asks the same two questions. Where are we going and why are we going there? They don't say what's your leadership style or something silly. They want to know where they're going and whether it's worth their effort to try to turn their life upside down to get there. Unfortunately, I found that most leaders can't answer that question in a compelling way. It seems like the default position on so many teams is we're going to go where we went last year, only we're going to be 12% better. Now, I don't know about you, but how many people turn their lives upside down and really want to sacrifice to be exactly where they already are, only 12% better? I mean, it would like be having an epitaph that says, here lies Gary Heil. He was 12% better. You're not going to turn your life upside down for that. You're just not going to do it. And we're asking people to make commitments in busy times, especially these days when their lives are turned upside down, when they've got so many things pulling at them that want their time. And we want their commitment and their discretionary effort. And we think that if we manipulate them a little more, we're going to get their full mind share. And we're just not, unless the cause that they're being asked to do brings meaning to their lives in substantial ways. And I don't know anybody who wants to sacrifice to get where they already are.
Absolutely. Now, you also talk about the compelling cause and worthy of commitment. So it's like when visions are compelling, then they resemble a cause. It's interesting. This morning, I was going to go exercise, and I was going to actually listen to a different type of a YouTube, and then an ad showed up. Gary, I started bawling. It was impressive. In this guy who was talking about you know, having a ball, doing everything. He was owning clubs. He was doing everything and so great, but he was feeling empty. And then he's just said, that's it. I'm going to go to the Doctors with Borders. And then from there, he created this vision for himself that, you know, he created a nonprofit organization to create clean water around the world. And I was just like listening to this and looking at how much when you experience this concept of having a cause and taking a stand for a cause, motivation is there. Nothing stops you and you move forward with it. So how can leaders create these opportunities for people to own that cause in a way?
I think what you just said was like a perfect explanation of it, right? And like you're channeling your inner Viktor Frankl, right? You know, that the real purpose of life is to find meaning. And the thing about meaning that, as you know, as a therapist, is that meaning isn't given, it's found. What's meaningful to you is not meaningful to me, right? And people find meaning in different things, but there has to be some substantial way for me to enrich my life. And most of the time we find meaning by something that we do in service to others. And it doesn't have to be curing cancer or feeding the hungry. I had a CEO once who took four companies public before his 40th birthday, who was in the software business, who said that, you know, writing software is not intrinsically interesting in and of itself, but being part of the best team in the world writing software is exhilarating for many. So you provide an opportunity where it's possible for the kind of people that you want to attract to find meaning. I don't think we even give it a reasonable effort many times. I don't know how many meetings we've all been in where the leader will stand up and go, we exist to enrich shareholder value. There isn't one person in that audience that goes, wow, that enriches my life. You know, I can't wait to sacrifice for that one. I mean, we all know we need to make money if we're a business in order to survive, right? And the more money I make, the more cool stuff I can do. But it isn't the reason I exist. It isn't the reason I come to work. It isn't how I find meaning. I find meaning in service to others, in helping others, in providing a product for others, in doing things that are part of a team that makes me proud to be there. And I think there are so many ways. They're not for everybody. But if you're looking to attract a certain person, you have to ask yourself as a leader, is what I'm asking them to do worthy of their sacrifice, apart from the money involved? And I think too often we really do think about it in economic terms instead of meaning terms, and we get lost that way.
And you talked about team, because when we're talking about loving and accepting, it can be throughout and for everyone. But there's still a team that works together, and we're choosing to bring a team together. And having the right people or not having the right people can really create an efficiency and, you know, less drama and working toward the cause that everybody's committed to. And having the wrong people in any type of relationship, whether it's, you know, your family setting, your intimate relationship, work relationship, the team you're working on, is going to suck a lot of energy out of the efficiency that you can move forward. And you talk about right people, and you say right people are eager to engage, eager to learn, and eager to make a contribution. They don't need to be jump-started into an action. In most cases, self-motivated and eager to be a part of something remarkable. So how do leaders kind of assess for having the right people around them and kind of allowing the wrong people to choose out, let's say?
Well, let's take the first part first, because it's the more difficult one, right? Finding the right people is not an exact art, is it? It's interviewing is not great all the time. And look, we do it so poorly. I mean, if you look at the way we do it to hire people today, we take resumes, which are puff pieces written by people to make, who knows, make me believe that we walk on water, right? And you get these resumes, then you bring people in for interviews, and you let everybody on the team interview them to make sure nobody has any objection to them, which makes sure that everybody that we hire looks exactly like and acts exactly like and thinks exactly like everybody we already have. And then we wake up one day and we go, oh my God, we have no diversity. Well, we have a diversity because we had a process which sorts out diversity. I mean, I asked a group not long ago, as they were all about innovation. And I said, well, do you hire people who are hard to manage, say no, or contrarian, continually challenge the status quo? And they go, why would we do that? And because innovation is conflictive, it's disruptive, and you need people like that. So I think our whole construct is a little off for what we say we want. The other thing is, I think we look so much at resumes, we don't look at their values as much as we should, number one. And I don't think, I think there's one truism. I think the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. You find somebody who is successful in everything they've done, you'll find somebody who will come and probably be successful where you are. And if they share your values and they share your mission, and then you go to the cause, are they excited about what you're trying to do? Are they excited about being part of an organization that sells widgets or whatever that you do, or cures hunger, whatever it is you're doing? They have to be excited about your cause, emotionally connected to the mission. And you're looking for people who are avid learners and successful at everything. Because I don't think in this day and age that you can continue to survive without learning, because yesterday's answers aren't very relevant tomorrow, I don't think.
Very much. How would you consider, because you said looking at the past behavior and that they are a success. What about the people who might have not succeeded or they failed, but they learned from it and they want to move forward and they really need an opportunity in a successful place to create, to role model from others, to be around them? How would you kind of weed out and figure, okay, maybe this person is also the right person, although maybe they weren't up to par really before?
Well, you know, you make a great point. And I think that I would take your words over mine, actually. Because it isn't success meaning they won the game, or success meaning they made a ton of money, or success meaning their startup made a gazillion dollars. Because you can be successful because of what you did or in spite of what you did. And it's nice to know the difference between the two. I do think that future behavior is predicted by past behavior, but you could have failed but done a great job. You could have failed but put your best effort in. You could have failed but be an avid learner. And the idea was just not a great idea. I mean, you could have failed yesterday. You could have been on a losing team, but being working hard and improving. So the predictor of future behavior might be your learning, your willingness to take risks, your willingness to be a good teammate. So I would agree with you. It depends on your definition of success. And it doesn't mean you win the game or make the money. It means that you are a learner and a good teammate and share similar values and are willing to work hard or have a lot of grit or resilient. I mean, those are the kind of things I would look for more than wins on the scoreboard. I like the way you put it better than the way I put it.
Thank you. I get it that the willingness of learning is what you're looking at. Either they had it and they showed some results, or they have it and they're yearning to show the result in the right capacity and in the right space. I've seen a lot of that where people from particular countries come to other countries and you see their percentage of flourishing. And these are the same people, but just the country they were coming from did not have the same allowance or the system. Or you see the person go into a culture of a corporation and that culture demeaning them, pushing them down. And then suddenly they go to another corporation and they're flourishing because the space of love that your book is about allows them to flourish. And I've seen that a lot. So that's why I was asking. Another concept.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I make a quick point about that because you're so right. One of the findings we had in our study, which really points how absolutely on point you make this, which is that when we studied leadership in the past, we studied the leader. How does that leader affect the group? We have done not near as much study in how the group or the culture in which the group acts limits the leader's ability to be successful. And culture tends to homogenize behavior, right? Culture inhibits change contrary to the culture. So if I put a leader in one culture and they are successful or unsuccessful, they won't be the same person when I put them in a different culture at all. Some of their personal characteristics may be the same, but you take a leader out of one and put them in another, they don't act the same way. I mean, I remember I ran into a Macy's HR manager 100 years ago who was trying to steal genetically superior Nordstrom employees. Because if he figured if he took those Nordstrom employees and put them in Macy's, Macy's would have great service. And we know how that worked out. Not very well, right? He put those Nordstrom employees in Macy's and they became some of the worst Macy's employees because they became more frustrated by the culture. We have ignored in the study of leadership the effect of culture on people. And your point's exactly right. When we take people out of one culture and we put them in another, they will act fundamentally differently. And if we don't understand the context where they came from and the context where they're going to, we'll make a lot of bad decisions.
Now I'm just creating a lot of questions for you. In the era that we live in, which we have different cultures of companies side by side. We have old traditional company corporate world that are there that are more competitive and even competitive within their own group. Like they create this kind of competition and the way that they give feedback to each from management to lower, mid management to bottom is constantly push. It's as if every single member of that group has to be a salesperson and they have to get a rate and an evaluation. And if you're out, you're out. We've seen that changes in banking industries. I mean, it went from service oriented to sales oriented and then like a harsh sales kind of a thing. And then and other industries who work very traditionally and hierarchical. And then we have also these new sets of companies who are coming up, which are more team oriented. Everybody's together 24 hours. They can go to gym together. They can drink together. They can be innovative. Some of them are all working from home. And it's not as hierarchical, although obviously a structure has to be there, but it doesn't run that way. What do you think of all of these different ways that are in the same market are living and competing and moving forward? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that it's not changing as fast as some of the constructs would have us believe. I think that there's very few things that get done these days that aren't done in teams. The individual almost never works alone anymore. And so we have to find a way to give credence to that and learn how to lead teams, maybe as the molecular unit of the organization instead of the individual, right? Because everything's about individual performance, appraisal, compensation, and really we work in teams. So I think that's an interesting change that's coming. But I think there's one trend in the study of leadership that the description that you gave fits. And it's happened over hundreds of years, not a decade. And that's the devolution of power from those that used to hold all the power to those who used to have no power is a trend that's only accelerating with technology. You know, leaders used to be all powerful and we used to have to do everything what they say. Now, a group of students can get the president of a university fired over a weekend. You know, you see people pushing back. So this move, especially in technology, to be more team-oriented and to have flatter organizational structures with more team leaders instead of traditional managers, is a recognition that if you want to hire the best and the most talented among us, you're going to have to share authority more significantly than ever in the past. And I think that trend continues to accelerate and will continue to accelerate as technology democratizes almost everything. So I think we're just in the beginning of that revolution. And I think leaders in the future are going to have to figure out, how do I lead when I have less authority and less position power, and the people that work with me that I want to follow have more power and more influence over the future of the organization? I think that trend that you're seeing is in its infancy.
And the next challenge that is showing up, and I really want to get your opinion about, how do this concept of the culture of love can extend itself now when most of your employees might not even be at the office due to the coronavirus and a lot of people are working from home, and how to create that teamwork and the extension of caring through Zoom
or through Slack. Boy, when you find the answer to that one, you've got it. I think it is a very interesting problem. And I think at first everybody saw this, wow, we survived working and doing Zoom. This is a way to cut costs. This is a way to give people freedom. And I think that there's some people that still feel that way. And there's others that think, you know, we are social animals. And if we don't have ways to connect with each other and fulfill our social needs when it comes to being connected to people at work, then it gets to be a lonely place, especially for those young single people who sit at their dining room table in their one bedroom apartments and say, look at this, right? It's a very different world. And so I think that age old question of how do I connect and fulfill the social needs I get from being part of a great team without ever being able to run is something that should concern us. And I would say it's not impossible to do in a Zoom link, you know, world, Teams world, but I think leaders have to focus more on it. And I think there's a danger in our world today that we confuse activity with progress and survival with good culture. I think we can survive this way. I don't know that we develop great cultures this way. I don't know that we're ever feeling fulfilled while we're at that. And I think it would be easy for a leader to get out of touch when I connect by Zoom once a week or once a day. I think you don't get the same feeling that you do when you walk into, I mean, you walk into lots of teams in your business. Don't you feel sometimes when you walk through the door, you can feel a great team before anybody opens their mouth? Don't you feel that way?
Absolutely. You could feel the connection with people. You could feel, like, even with the family system, you know, family walks in and I know exactly they're fighting, but the way their body language is together, the way, you know, with softness, they look at each other, you get the attachment, you get the love, you get like the, you know, the loyalty that they have with each other. I was watching a soccer game. And at the end of the soccer game, one of the guys who had the team who had lost, and you could see the guys coming together. And for the last person who actually like was a kind of like a responsible one to lose, was holding his head and kissing his head with such a love and compassion to take that grief away from him. And I was like, wow. Like you see that and it's like, now this team is a winner. Yes, the other one won, but you looked at the way that they handle their loss together. It's beautiful when you handle the, you know, the emergence and the beautiful celebration, but also, you know, all teams at times lose and all companies at times go through the up and down. And the way that this group was together, it was like, you know, if this is what you do when you lose, you're going to be amazing when you win.
And people have to lose. I mean, and yeah. Even the best winners that I've ever interviewed or studied or worked with lost along the way.
Yeah.
Were fired at some point in their life, got on a team that didn't fit their persona. I think you see a lot of that. And the truth is that I think if you ever have been part of that kind of team that loves each other, and people have euphemism for them, like they call themselves part of a family, or they have each other's backs, or whatever words they use if it's not love to describe it. If you've been part of that, you're changed in the process.
Yes.
You will never be the same.
Yes.
You know what it feels like to be part of a great team. Nothing else ever measures up that
hey,
isn't
bro,
that way.
How's it going, man?
And I think people who have experienced that spend their whole lives
cool.
looking
Did you,
for it
get
again.
That number
because
that I sent you of
the euphoria of that, the fulfillment of that, the
oh, okay.
meaning that comes from that.
Yeah, just shoot him a text.
I was talking to Jill Ellis, who was the women's national team soccer coach, 2014-2019, won two World Cups.
Make sure that he
and
is up
when
you get there.
When you look at the women soccer players on the national team, there's conflict, there's competition, there's turnover, there's a lot of things that go into creating a great team that aren't all fun. But at the end of the day, when you watch those women, even off the soccer pitch, talk to each other, talk about each other, they call themselves sisters. They call themselves a family. And the love that they have for each other is unmistakable. And when the competition comes down and the difference between Company A or Team A or School A and School B isn't very great, the difference that sometimes pushes over the edge, and I think our friend Dabo Swinney had it right when he won the national championships at Clemson. He said, we were going to win because we love each other, because when it comes down to the end, that's going to carry us through. And people laugh. I mean, the guy, after he said that and won the national championship, the guy, local paper at the Tampa Bay Times said, cool it. You know, kind of like cool it, Dabo. That's not what it's about. Love. Yeah. You know, what's love got to do with it? And
a lot.
Almost everything, right?
Yeah. And I was just reading the title of your book again, Choose Love, Not Fear, How the Best Leaders Built Cultures of Engagement and Innovation That Unleash Human Potential. And that is so even true in the era that we live in all aspects. You know, we're going to go through election, the whole world is under this type of a pandemic, and it's so easy to promote and lead and dictate, let's say, through fear versus love. And this is so beautiful that your book is coming out now, and because it really gives a lot of message in all sorts of teams, whether, again, they're in a family system or in a corporation or us as a society together, or as, you know, countrymen and women or whatever. I mean, however you look at it, from any kind of team that you could look at, which we're all living relations and teams, that this really, really brings and lands an important message. In 1 minute, if there's anything we haven't covered and you really want everyone who's watching or listening to us to know about you and your book.
Well, I think your questions have been terrific. It made me think, obviously. So I thank you for that. And I thank you for the kind words about our work. I think that I would leave you the thing that I kind of get left with a little. And it's a friend of ours who runs what Worth Magazine calls the best run charity in the world, Give Kids the World. And she has a sign in her office that still makes me think. Pam Landworth has a sign in her office as the CEO of Give Kids the World. It just says, it's not about me. And as a leader, I think in a world where it's my compensation and my job and my security and my ego, Pam practices in a world where she looks at that sign every day when she walks out of her office, and she realizes that it's not about her. It's about the 2,000 volunteer hours a week she gets at the Kids Village to help terminally ill kids and their families have an experience in Orlando. It's not about her. It's the associates that dedicate their lives to serving those families. It's not about her. It's about the families who are going through the toughest time in their life. And when I find the Pam Landworths or the Dabo Sweeneys or these leaders that we met in our stuff, they may not all have the sign in their office, but the vulnerability and the way that they think about the world and the people they care about are fundamentally different, because for them, it isn't about them, it's about those they serve. And so I think it's not my lesson, it's the lesson Pam Landworth taught me, so much so that I put her sign in my little office to remind me that when we talk about leadership, it really isn't about us, and that we focus too much on a leader and not enough on the people that we hope to lead.
Thank you so much. Thank you for spending the time with us. It's been a pleasure to have you. For everyone, please, please go to Amazon and everywhere that you could go to, and even GaryHile.com. Gary and Dr. Ryan Heil wrote this wonderful book, Choose Love, Not Fear, How the Best Leaders Built Cultures of Engagement and Innovation That Unleash Human Potential. Thank you again for being on my show.
Hey, thank you. I really enjoyed it. I hope we get to meet again soon.
Same here. And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week.